Hey folks, I'm Nick D'Alessandro, and this is Wait 5 Minutes, a podcast about Florida by a Floridian. We're getting near the end of the spring season now, and I've already got some big plans for the season ahead and some bonus episodes in the coming weeks. I have some ideas for next season that I thought about writing for the spring, but this summer, my plan is to just take us on a bunch of road trips for the show, go all over the state, so I thought I'd save some episodes for when we're out on the road exploring some new sites. But I had a story that I discovered while writing about Zora Neale Hurston earlier this spring, a thread that I pulled which turned up some really fascinating stories of war and swamps. The episode took a different direction, the Zora episode, but I couldn't throw out the script that opened the episode, so I saved it, and now I present to you a game. It's called Guess the President. I'll give you a few facts. Let's see if you can guess who I'm talking about before we get the name. Okay. And there's a little clue in that I told you Zora Neale Hurston is connected, but yeah, you're going to have to work it out. Here we go. He was a war hero. He was a lawyer. He was a member of the House of Representatives and the Senate. He was known for his handsome looks and charisma. He struggled with alcohol through his life and perhaps was an alcoholic. He is remembered mostly for his connection to the ending of slavery in the United States. Can you guess? I'll give you some more specifics, and I'm sure they will help, right? Okay. He served one term as president. He was elected in 1852. He was out of office by 1857. He was the 14th president. Come on. I know you know this. The 16th president was Abraham Lincoln. Before him was James Buchanan. And before James Buchanan was... Can you guess? Did you get it? If you got it, gold star to you. If you didn't, perfectly fine. A study was done in 2014 where, quote, nearly 500 adults age 18 to 24 write down names of as many presidents as they could remember in 5 minutes, end quote. The obvious ones are obvious. Washington, Lincoln, Kennedy, Adams, Reagan, Obama, Nixon, Bush. But the most obscure ones became obvious very quickly through the statistics. The least memorable president was Chester Arthur, our 21st president, serving from 1881 to 1885. His tenure as president is actually fascinating, as he was elected as James A. Garfield's vice president. Garfield, however, was shot by Charles J. Gatto just 4 months after Garfield's inauguration. He died nearly 3 months after the shooting, and Chester A. Arthur assumed the presidency after him. Despite this, Arthur was only recognized by 6.7% of those polled. The second least memorable president, however, was the subject of our Guess the President quiz. The 14th president, war hero, congressman, and apparent all-around failure, Franklin Pierce. Only 7.1% of those polled remembered Franklin Pierce. That is a tough blow for a man known as Young Hickory. That nickname, Young Hickory, came from Franklin's devotion to President Andrew Jackson, who was known colloquially as Old Hickory. Franklin Pierce wasn't much of a notable figure until the 1850s, when the Democrats and the Whigs were making compromises, literally to sort out what to do about the increasing problem of slavery. The American government was torn on how to solve the problem as abolition became more and more of a movement. The parties were divided amongst themselves, though the Democrats were far more in favor of keeping the inhumane practice in place. Pierce wanted to play both sides and went about, quote, filling his cabinet with extremists from both sides of the slavery debate, end quote. This, however, made him hated by both sides. Those in favor of slavery called him an abolitionist, and abolitionists accused him of being pro-slavery. By trying to play both sides, he played neither. He would fill his presidency with more questionable decisions, including a failed attempt to purchase Cuba and the baffling signing of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which led to fallout and violence in that region for years to come. That was sparked by slavery. We mentioned Bloody Kansas a little bit in that Buffalo Bill episode from earlier this year. The Kansas-Nebraska conflict led to Buffalo Bill's father being stabbed. Anyway, you need to know this. Pierce failed to lower the temperature on the slavery debate, and his own party would oust him in favor of James Buchanan, a president who yet increased the heat even further so that Abraham Lincoln's election in 1860 would spark the American Civil War, a war fought over slavery, the exact debate that was raging 10 years earlier that Franklin Pierce only heightened in his brief and clearly forgettable term as the 14th president of the United States. Maybe you'll remember him now. Probably not, though. As far as I know, Franklin Pierce had minimal connections to Florida, outside of his brother, Benjamin Kendrick Pierce. Benjamin Kendrick Pierce would go on to be the namesake for the city of Fort Pierce, where Zora Neale Hurston lived at the end of her life, the exact detail that brought me to this story in the first place. What exactly did Benjamin Kendrick Pierce do to earn a whole town named after him? Surely being the brother of a president isn't enough to warrant that, right? No, Benjamin was a soldier, and he fought in the Second Seminole War here in Florida, a bloody conflict that the American military waged against the native people of this land over where the government would allow them to live. Pierce, like so many other soldiers and leaders during the Second Seminole War, had the town named after him. Seriously, you would be amazed how many towns throughout Florida are just named after a guy who fought in the Second Seminole War. I bet it is a higher percentage than you would realize. Anyway, the Second Seminole War was a terrible war, fought in the untamed wilds of Florida nature, and many of the conflicts were drastically altered by the nature's impact on it. The fact is that the native warriors, the Seminoles, they knew the land in Florida better than the American soldiers, many of whom didn't even live in Florida. The Seminoles used that to their advantage, and one of the most fascinating battles in which Benjamin Kendrick Pierce was involved showcased exactly how nature was used in the war. That is the Battle of Wahoo Swamp. Today, we go there, to a war in a swamp, and how the conflict changed the trajectory of the war in our state. Before we go forward, though, as I was writing the script, I found myself using language to differentiate between the two sides in the conflict. On one side, there were the Seminoles, the resistance, the native people of the state of Florida, fighting to keep their home. On the other side was the United States government and their military, fighting to remove the Seminoles. In this episode going forward, I will be referring to the U.S. government and its military as the Americans, that is, the nation that they represented. Obviously, this is complicated as, of course, the Seminoles were here long before European colonization. To call this land, America, the land of the government, it's just complicated, but that is the distinction I'm making. It's how this war was fought. It was between the United States of America and their government, and the native people in Florida united under the title of Seminole. It is important to clarify that complicated difference, at least for this episode going forward. There's the Americans and the Seminoles. We begin in 1823, 200 years ago. In 1823, the First Seminole War was officially put to bed with the signing of the Treaty of Moultrie Creek. The First Seminole War had been fought a few years earlier, in 1817 and 1818, but with this treaty, it was over. Seminole leaders met with the first territorial governor of our state, William Pope Duval, the first official one. Of course, Andrew Jackson held a similar title before, but the first official territorial governor, William Pope Duval. The deal was simple. A reservation of land would be set aside for the Seminoles in the heart of the state, 4 million acres. America did leave in some stipulations, of course, notably that, quote, white settlers could build roads and seek runaway slaves within the reservation, end quote. The government also agreed to help pay for the new settlement of Seminole land. That didn't exactly come to pass. Neither did the exact lines of demarcation. No one quite stayed within the boundaries, so the effects of the treaty were blurry at best. But still, the treaty was in place, and it gave land to the Seminoles to live on. For a few years there, it looked like the first war would lead to a lasting peace. I wish I knew what people thought at the time. Were people happy with the arrangement? Obviously, the Seminoles were not. They wanted their land back. We did an episode many years ago about the origins of the Seminole Indians. I will link to that episode in the description of this episode, but we learned then that the Seminoles were really made up of many different native Floridian peoples and formerly enslaved persons living with them in their settlements. I wish we knew what their feelings were of this new reservation at the time, because it didn't last long, and when it fell apart, it led to war. 7 years after the signing of that treaty, it's now 1830, and President Andrew Jackson signed into law the Indian Removal Act, a devastating plan by the government to move all native people, quote, to lands west of the Mississippi River, end quote. Another treaty was signed in Florida in 1832, the Treaty of Payne's Landing, which gave some consolation to the Seminole people. Quote, it called for the Seminoles to move within 3 years to the land assigned to the Creek Indians west of the Mississippi if Seminole leaders found the land to be suitable and for the Seminoles to be absorbed by the Creeks. End quote. Some consolation. Oh, and the black Seminoles were to be left, quote, so that they could be claimed as slaves, end quote. A violent and terrifying treaty, frankly. Another treaty was signed, and it was looking like the Seminoles would be leaving Florida and going west, but this proved to be an incomplete portrait of the Seminoles' plan. Rather than going, near the end of 1835, on December 28th, Seminoles ambushed Major Francis Dade and his 100 soldiers, quote, killing all but three, end quote. The Seminoles weren't going to go without a fight. Within a few days, by the end of 1835, three attacks by the Seminoles against the Americans were carried out, and the Seminoles now had the upper hand. The Americans were surprised and out of their depth. As it became 1836, the Seminoles didn't let up, and the Americans struggled to find ways to fight back. As you're going to find through the rest of this episode, the Seminoles made the Americans look like fools. January was filled with more bloodshed as the Seminoles kept striking locations essential to American settlement in this land. Plantations were sacked all throughout Florida. A few weeks into January, on the 17th, one plantation in northern Florida was the target. Dunlawton Plantation became the next target for the Seminoles, led by Coacoochee, a fearsome Seminole warrior who was also known as a Wildcat. Wildcat wore a distinctive ornament into battle at Dunlawton Plantation. Reflectors from a fallen lighthouse. The stories go that a lighthouse had been built on what is now Ponce Inlet, down by present-day New Smyrna. Back then, the inlet was called Mosquito Inlet, and a lighthouse had been built there just a few months earlier in 1835. A hurricane swept through in September of 1835 and brought the lighthouse down, leaving rubble along the coast. Coacoochee had apparently taken bits of the reflector, the part of the lighthouse that reflected the lamp out to sea, and he wore them as ornaments into Dunlawton, where his band of rebels burned the plantation to the ground. The American military arrived, led by Benjamin Putnam, by boats set to defend the plantation, only to discover they were too late. The Americans surged to fight off the Seminoles, who briefly retreated, only to come fighting back. Quote, Coacoochee soon arrived with several hundred warriors, and the troops were overwhelmed. They retreated back to their boats, end quote. Several Americans were hurt, they lost a boat, and the very location they came to defend was now ash. This was the Seminoles' strategy in the early years of the Second Seminole War. Strike important locations, for example, quote, plantations, outposts, and supply lines, end quote, and do it quickly. Fight, destroy, vanish. As for Coacoochee, he remained an essential leader to the Seminole fight. We'll have to dig into his life story another day because he, alongside Chief Osceola, was a huge leader in the Second Seminole War. He actually was captured, but he escaped prison from a fort by fasting for 6 days until he was so skinny that he could just slip through the bars. That is quite a story. He's hardcore. They called him Wildcat for a reason. But the Americans would not be kept on the back foot forever. Florida had been hard-fought land for them, and President Andrew Jackson wanted his Indian Removal Act to be upheld, including in Florida, a place that he had fought a lot in. This was the last year of Jackson's presidency, and though he would soon be out of the White House, the new president, Martin Van Buren, kept up the force of wanting the native peoples moved along the Trail of Tears. He was enforcing the Indian Removal Act during his presidency. Not enough of what happened on the Trail of Tears is placed on his name, but I would like you to remember that it wasn't just Andrew Jackson alone. Martin Van Buren held up and enforced it as well. But Andrew Jackson was the one who saw the chaos going on in the state he had once briefly been in charge of, and he saw to it that action be taken to stop the Seminole forces. Enter Major General Winfield Scott, a veteran of the War of 1812 and the Mexican-American War, and now the Second Seminole War. Andrew Jackson appointed General Scott to make his way into the state and push back the Seminole resistance. The report is that he had 5,000 men ready to launch a true blue military campaign through the state to weed out the Seminoles. The soldiers would work through regions of the state, clear the land of threats, in three columns. They would move slowly and expunge the Seminoles. By March of 1836, they were ready to go. but the Seminoles were no fools. Their plan to cut off supply lines had succeeded in making the soldiers run low on supplies quickly, and the Seminoles would attack the columns of soldiers as they got on the move. So the soldiers would start marching, and then the Seminoles would just pop in, raise hell, disappear. The campaign was intended to have all three columns reunite at the same time at the Cove of Withlacoochee in the middle of the state, but they were delayed. The Seminoles wiped out their supplies, led the army to pursue locations in search of Seminoles, only to find none, and even directly attack the columns meant to weed them out. The Seminoles got the better of Major General Winfield Scott, and by the end of March, Scott had conceded defeat. One of many American soldiers who realized this fight was no good for them. His campaign was an abject failure. The Seminoles had more victories under their belt. They knew the land, they moved quick, and they removed the structures and systems that would allow the army to survive. Everything in 1836 so far was working in their favor. I find it remarkable how unprepared the Americans were and how long it took for them to get themselves in a position where they could actually maybe leave a dent in the Seminole resistance. Obviously, the forts and the plantations, they were destroyed. That was intentional by the Seminoles to take out these footholds, but still, this was not that long after other wars. This military had been fighting in conflicts pretty much since the country was founded 50 years earlier, but they were totally inept in this situation. They were just being outfoxed time and time again. Spring did not end their plight. The Seminoles were not only destructive and consistent and hard to pin down, but they seemed to drive members of the American military to madness. Some soldiers, leaders in the army, called it a career and just left the war. It had driven them mad. The Seminoles were just everywhere. North Florida, Tampa, the Atlantic coast, all the way down to what would one day be Miami. Everywhere, the Seminoles had soldiers ready and willing to do damage. A great example of this is on the small island of Key Biscayne off the southern coast of Florida. A decade earlier, a lighthouse was built on the island in 1825. Next year, actually, will be its 200th anniversary. Maybe we'll pay it a visit. It was constructed back then to protect ships from crashing into the reefs around the perimeter of the state of Florida. The Seminoles went after everything. I keep telling you that. Any infrastructure that the Americans were using in Florida, and clearly the lighthouse, was part of that. Because in July of 1836, the Seminoles came for the Cape Florida Lighthouse on Key Biscayne. They fired rifles into the lighthouse, and the keeper fired back. The defense was not enough, and the Seminoles lit the base of the lighthouse aflame. The lighthouse keeper and his assistant scaled the stairs as the flames grew. Here is just an insane detail in this story. Quote, "The keeper threw down gunpowder, thinking it would cause a huge explosion and mercifully end their lives. But it actually wound up sparing the keeper. His assistant died in the conflict, but the Seminoles thought the explosion within the lighthouse had finished the job, so they left. A boat heard the explosion at a distance and came to save the keeper from his sorry state. It would take a decade for the lighthouse to be properly rebuilt, but it remains despite the brief skirmish in the heart of the war." It's just a perfect example of the relentless attacks of the Seminoles. They had been betrayed by a treaty they had previously agreed to, and this was their stand against that. Summer rolled in, and the state of Florida in the heart of summer might as well have been hell on earth. The American army didn't have enough men, their forts were quickly being destroyed or abandoned, and the land they were supposed to be defending was far from hospitable to them. Nothing was going their way. The Seminoles had figured out how to turn everything against them. The Americans would need to pivot, and for them, there was a man with a plan. His name was Richard Keith Call. Born in Virginia in 1792, Richard was the nephew of a Revolutionary War veteran of the same name, Richard Call. At the age of 21, Richard joined up with Andrew Jackson, volunteering to serve under Old Hickory as he started up his infamous military campaign that would raise Jackson's profile exponentially. Call was there in the battles of Pensacola and New Orleans, two of Jackson's most famous battles. When the first Seminole War broke out in 1817, Call was on Jackson's personal staff. Florida became essential to his life as he became a resident of Pensacola and started serving in Congress representing Florida from 1823 to 1825. He also kept a residence in Tennessee, but in 1824, himself, his new wife, and, quote, 10 enslaved people relocated to Tallahassee, end quote. The Grove is the land that the Calls owned at the time, and today there is a museum, the Grove Museum. This is their exact wording on Call regarding his enslavement of many people. Quote, "From his arrival to Tallahassee until the time of his death, Call purchased and exploited the labor of skilled enslaved people to run his brickyard, railroad, and land development operations," end quote. This same man would serve as Florida's territorial governor in two different periods, from 1836 to 1839, and again from 1841 to 1844. And in that first time, from 36 to 39, Call was dealing with the very active, very real threat of the Second Seminole War. He came to the job in March, and he even served as part of that failed spring campaign under General Scott. He saw what wasn't working, and he wanted to change the tides. You see, the American military was using soldiers. Call had another way to supply men, by allowing them to volunteer or by simply paying militiamen. He got volunteers from Tennessee, where he was from. He got other friendly warriors. We'll hear more about the type of people that fought in his army later, but it wasn't the typical infantry. This was a different plan for him. The plan was similar, though, to that of the campaign from the spring. Meet at the Withlacoochee and set up an encampment. Now, the Withlacoochee is right in that middle area on the west part of Florida, so it's sort of between Tampa and Ocala and Claremont. It's in that middle area, right on I-75, you know what I mean? So it has a big water basin, the Withlacoochee River, and there's a lot of swamps in that area. And clearly, because this area was near the Seminoles' land that was in the middle of the state that they had been given during that treaty, this area became sort of an essential point that they were trying to capture, clearly, because they kept going after it. The water, however, was high on the river, and the boat that they sent to meet them got stuck in the water. And, you guessed it, the Seminoles were attacking them as they tried to make their way along the water, firing at Call's men as they moved along the riverbanks. Call seemed like he was the guy to finally get the Americans in the fight, but by October, as his plan, yet another plan, failed to find any traction, it was looking dire for the soldiers. It had been 11 months from December of 1835 to October of 1836 of the Americans being simply shown up time and time again. From December to October, the destruction was near constant, and they never even came close to securing a victory against a resistance force that had theoretically far less resources than them. By November, Call was ready to make a move again and lead them to what was ostensibly the first American victory in the Second Seminole War, or at least the closest thing to one. In mid-November, Richard K. Call set out to the Withlacoochee again, this essential land he wanted to secure. Call had a number of soldiers behind him, including, quote, U.S. Army troops, Tennessee volunteers, Friendly Creek soldiers, and the Florida militia, totaling around 1,830 men, end quote. So he did have American soldiers, but he had lots of other different fighters involved in this conflict. Call left from Fort Drane, which was west of the Withlacoochee on the Gulf Coast. He departed on November 10th. From there, he marched 10 miles until crossing the river on the 13th. Some of his soldiers anticipated finding a Seminole encampment in that area, but found it abandoned, save for one person, I'm reading, who they took as a hostage. They burned the village to the ground and kept moving in search of the Seminoles that they knew were hiding out of sight. This region they were now warring into was the Wahoo Swamp, though all my research indicates that it was only really called that in reference to this battle. But the swamp was as thick of Florida land as there could be in this region, with dense wood and complicated wetlands. Soldiers marching could not really have their traditional movements or even combat here, and the Seminoles would be able to move in and out, especially if they were moving in small numbers. The Americans had brought in nearly 2,000 men. That amount of enforcements proved in the Americans' favor, however, because on November 17th, when a skirmish broke out, the size of the troops there gave the Americans an upper hand. A Seminole camp was found by a band of Tennessee mounted volunteers, and they pushed in. Off their horses and into the hammock, the volunteers fought the Seminoles for a half hour until the Seminoles retreated, leaving 20 dead on the battlefield, alongside quote-unquote supplies and horses. The Americans only lost one in the fight, though some were wounded. It was a smaller fight, but it was the first in the trio of conflicts that became the Battle of Wahoo Swamp. The next day, the numbers were much larger, and the fight was much bigger. On November 18th, William Trousdale, who would one day be the 13th governor of the state of Tennessee, he pursued Seminoles into the swamp, charging straight into the hammock while his mounted soldiers hung back. To me, the difference in this attack compared to all the other American assaults was twofold. One, they finally had enough men. And two, they actually knew where the Seminoles were, so they could essentially find a spot of land where the Seminoles were biding their time, surround it, and lunge in. That is what happened here. What's fascinating about the skirmish on this day is that the Americans were actually outnumbered. Quote, they numbered around 500 to 550 men and battled an estimated 600 to 700 Seminoles, end quote. That is a lot of people involved in this fight, and even more shocking to me is how small the casualties were. 25 Seminoles were, quote, dead on the field, but total casualty estimates vary due to their tendency to carry the wounded and dead from the battlefield, end quote. If you read anything about the Second Seminole War, that seems to be a repeated theme. The number that's listed is how many were left dead on the battlefield, and then they give a number of how many soldiers were carried away who were wounded or were dying when they were carried away. You see that number a lot in these firsthand accounts from the Second Seminole War that were usually based on diaries or accounts from the military at this time. So for the Americans, only three were killed, a vast disparity, despite the mortalities being low compared to the 1,000 men battling that day. For what it was worth to them, the Americans were finally finding ways to strike back against the resistance. They'd wait a few days, but on November 21st, they finally entered the Wahoo Swamp proper with all the nearly 2,000 soldiers leading three columns into the wild. All the reports of this event focus on the dangers of trying to push their way through the swamp. Arranging three columns of soldiers into battle can be hard in any atmosphere, but bringing unprepared horses into the high waters of a dense swamp, that's a whole other story. Regardless, the sheer number of the American force is what granted them something akin to a victory here. There was some fighting, some skirmish, with the Americans losing 24 or so, and the Seminoles losing perhaps up to 50 soldiers. But what was essential to the Americans was they got the Seminoles to retreat. But the Americans still went home defeated. You see, the plan was to be able to push through the swamp, continue their pursuit, and end the Seminole threat expeditiously. But fording the water proved impossible, and they even lost a key figure in that process, a Creek soldier named David Moniak. David was Creek, and he joined up at West Point in 1817, making him possibly the first Native American to graduate from that military academy when he graduated in 1822. His entire life was fascinating, perhaps a story we'll go into another time, but his short life ended in the Second Seminole War in the Wahoo Swamp. As he tried to cross the water to see the depth of it to allow the other members of the columns to cross, he was shot and killed. He was 33. He is buried, actually, in Florida. We must pay him a visit in the near future. Moniak's death, and the indication that the water at Wahoo Swamp was impossible to cross, led Richard Keith Call to an important decision. He decided to turn back. Despite driving away the Seminoles in three separate attacks, despite bringing his campaign to their first somewhat successful encounters with the Seminoles since the war began nearly a year earlier, Call was relieved of his duties in December. He was replaced by Thomas Jessup, who would eventually lead the Americans to the capture of Chief Osceola, the first real turning point of the Second Seminole War. War is ugly and strange, and this period of America saw loads of war over the native lands of this continent's indigenous inhabitants. Colonialism is a brutal thing to fight over, and the native people of our country fought it for years. Florida's Seminole Wars came about from several injustices perpetuated by the American government and resulted in bloodshed all over the state, from the Panhandle to the Keys, from the Atlantic to the Gulf Coast. The Second Seminole War was transformative, and it was filled with many different people involved who fought in various eras and chapters in the war's story. My hope is that we will explore more of that war in this show. I'm planning on diving deep on Chief Osceola's life sometime next year. But 1836 is perhaps one of the most fascinating and under-discussed years in our state's history. 1835, that's when the Second Seminole War began. 1837, that is when Osceola was captured. But throughout 1836, the Seminoles burned plantations and forts, slipped out safe without capture, and certainly spent the better part of the year giving the Americans as much hell as they could stand. When the war was over a few years later, the Seminoles would find themselves in the Everglades, never surrendering to American forces. That is why, as I've told you many times, the Seminoles are still known as the Unconquered People. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Wait 5 Minutes. I'm so glad that you are here. I have included in this episode description a link to the things going on in the Seminole Tribe of Florida. To all the Native people of Florida, Betty Osceola is a figure who you should know and who you should be following. I have included links at the top of the episode description. All you need to do is click on the episode description. It will be the first thing that you see. Links to the Seminole Tribe, links to Atatiki, the Seminole Museum, and links to things that Betty Osceola is doing and asking for people to help with in the Everglades right now. Go read about that. Go see what's going on. And we will be talking about that in the very, very near future. I will also be including some links to some of my resources for this episode. This is a fascinating period of American history, and so much of it has been written about, but there's not enough of it that people know, frankly, in my opinion, and I'd like to have some part in making sure that more of it is discussed on this show, because this era was so hugely important, and there's so many figures that connect to the broader chapters of American history, so we'll be talking about this more in the very near future. All the music used in this episode was originally composed. All right, folks, next week is the beginning of our two-part finale dedicated to Florida's presence at America's iconic World's Fairs. We're going to be going throughout time talking about different World's Fairs and talking about different ways that Florida was involved. And I've been wanting to talk about this for a long time, and I'm really excited to explore that in these episodes for the finale. Plus, keep an eye out on the show's Instagram because we're going to the Florida Film Festival, and I will be posting about it on my personal Instagram, on the Wait 5 Minutes Instagram. I'm really excited for, I'll actually have been there the entire weekend if you've listening to this now, and I'll be there Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of this week. So if you're around, come say hey. I'm the guy with the mustache and the beard. Come say hello. I'd love to see you. But we'll be back next week with the episodes about the World's Fair, and keep an eye out for that Florida Film Festival episode very soon. Until then, be good to yourself, be good to others. Drink more water and go Gator and muddy the water. Have a great week. I will see you next Monday.